We did what we said we were going to do, and it did work.
Rick Snyder wants another term as governor.
We are on the road to recovery.
I'm Rick Pluta from the Michigan Public Radio Network. This is Michigan Calling. Over the next hour, we'll be talking with Governor Snyder and taking your calls, tweets, and Facebook messages.
The jobs are coming back in Michigan.
Jobs, the state economy, education. What questions do you have? Call us 313-577-1019. The number again, 313-577-1019. Message us on Facebook, find us at Michigan Calling, or tweet us, use the hashtag MICalling. Your questions for Governor Rick Snyder coming up. Welcome to this election year special broadcast on the Michigan Public Radio Network. I'm Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for Michigan Public Radio. We are going to spend the next hour talking to Governor Rick Snyder, who is running for re-election this year. We'll be talking with the governor about issues that matter to Michigan voters, and we know that because the questions are coming from you. From jobs in the economy to education and the environment, this is your chance to ask the questions. The phone number to join the conversation is 313-577-1019. Again, that's 313-577-1019. You can also message us on Facebook. We are at Michigan Calling, or tweet us. Use the hashtag MICalling. A quick note before we go to your questions. We did have Democratic candidate for Governor Mark Schauer on Michigan Calling last month, and you can find that program on the Michigan Calling Facebook page. You should also know both candidates accepted our invitation without negotiations or conditions set in advance regarding topics, format, or follow-up questions. They agreed to simply show up and answer your questions. With that, Governor Snyder, welcome.
It's great to be with you, Rick.
And we are going to go to our first question on public education.
Hi, this is Liz Rodriguez from Ypsilanti, and I'm concerned about equity in funding of public education, specifically the differences between poor districts and wealthier districts. Thank you.
Liz, I appreciate your question. That's something that's been a topic for some time, and we've been proactively addressing that. There is a gap between the highest and lowest school districts in terms of the state foundation allowance, and we've been working to close that gap. This last budget year, I recommended a larger increase for the lowest districts versus the higher ones. In fact, the legislature went farther than that and even put more dollars. So essentially, if you looked at the current budget we approved, it's $150 going to the lowest funded districts and $50 going to other districts. And that will take some time to address that discrepancy, but we've actually chipped away at it somewhat most of the years I've been in office.
Should the goal be ultimately for the state to have one foundation grant, one per student state aid payment that's equal for every student, regardless of which school district they're in?
Well, that's something we should be talking about, Rick. That is a good topic to ask. It really reflects going back to Proposal A. If you go back to the funding and all those kind of issues, that it was part of the compromise to get that done that created those discrepancies. I think it's important to reduce them. I think there's some other good school funding questions, though, that should be on the table as part of that broad discussion. That's something I view for second term.
Okay. We're going to go now to Janet from Troy. Janet, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. As a parent, I'm beyond appalled at the billion-dollar cut to the education budget, and cutting the education budget means that our children are going to be less prepared for the future and less prepared to take on successful jobs. How can we expect to prosper as a state and a community when we aren't prepared for preparing our children for the future?
Okay, Janet, thanks for your call, Governor.
Yeah, Janet, I really appreciate your question because it shows the misinformation that people are getting. And the issue is you've got bad information. And that's unfortunately a part of the broken political system we have where politics overwhelms fact. The good part is, I can tell you, with respect to our investment in K-12 with state dollars for education, since the first three years I was in office, we put over $1 billion during that three-year period into public education for K-12. The budget I just approved for this last year is $1 billion higher than the year before I took office. So we've made very large investments in public education.
A lot of that money is savings from pension and benefit reforms, school employee pension and benefit reforms. Is that money taking too long to make its way into the classroom?
Actually, a couple things, Rick, to go to your point. That savings number is actually savings. Those are dollars they would otherwise have to pay. That amounts to over $300 a student that school districts would have to pay if we hadn't done those reforms and made payment plans. A big part of what we're paying is we're actually putting dollars into the schools to help them pay their retirement obligations. In fact, that's the biggest part of the money in terms of the new dollars that have gone in is the school districts are responsible for making sure teachers and other public school employees have their pensions. And to make sure those payments are made, they weren't going to be able to make those payments. Those costs have increased dramatically over the last decade. And so the state, we agreed to actually provide dollars to help give them the resources so they can make those payments. And that's a huge amount of money going into school districts. And the other good part is, and many teachers don't realize this, what we're doing and actually our payments into the K-12 system are helping ensure that they have a pension when they retire that otherwise was in jeopardy.
Let's touch on one of the more controversial aspects of your education policy, and that's the Education Achievement Authority. To say that your critics consider this a failure might even be an understatement, that there are mixed results for the students who are in these schools. Is this really the best option? Are there other ways to go about trying to fix the lowest performing schools?
Rick, there are a lot of things that should be considered and looked at. That's part of innovation. And a lot of this is what I would say is these were the worst performing schools in the state of Michigan. There are essentially schools there that were zero college ready. The traditional system did not work with respect to these kids. And so isn't it important you try to come up with innovative ideas? So we actually looked at best practices. We had a lot of help from experts around the country, some of the leading educational people and organizations. And so the Educational Achievement Authority is really taking two or three things that I think are really important. One, they're modeling the concept of more year-round school. And I think the evidence is very strong that year-round school, particularly for students that are challenged, that are having a difficult environment, they can do better in that environment. The other one is the concept of student-centered learning, really empowering the students. And so that takes some time to show up, but student-centered learning is a very powerful model that's been very successful in other places. It's being done in other schools in Michigan. And it's one of the foremost ideas of the Educational Achievement Authority that is working. If you go to those schools, and this is where, again, there's a lot of misinformation out there.
But then why the mixed results?
Well, again, it takes some time when you're talking about kids at the lowest performing percentage. So, for example, one of the things that people often misinterpret, they weren't found to be totally ready in terms of their numbers, but you got to remember, they're starting several grades lower. So you don't make up several grades in 1 year. It takes multiple years. The real question is, has there been student growth from the last time they were really gone through, tested, or assessed in some fashion? And they're showing results there.
Okay, and we have a message on Twitter from Ken. Mm-hmm. Governor, why are you expanding charter schools when enrollment is dropping across the state?
Yeah, that's a fair question to ask. And what we did is really take the cap off charter schools. I don't expand or contract charter schools. It's really to say, where are there appropriate educational opportunities that people think there could be a school? I think there is a question that's worth asking in the longer term and about what are the standards for all our schools.
Yeah, but when you make it easier to open new charter schools, you are essentially expanding charter schools.
That's what you're doing is expanding the opportunity. That doesn't mean a school is going to go in. Again, there needs to be enough demand for that school to exist, to be successful. And that's part of the question that I think is a fair question to ask is, what's the supply and demand of schools and students in our state?
Is the supply adequate to the demand for charters at this
point? Well,
that's
one of the things I'd like to look at, not just for charter schools, but for all schools. Do we have a supply and demand issue in what areas of the state? I think that's a good question that we should be doing more analysis, both for traditional districts and charters.
What does that mean?
That means, again, basically looking at how many students there are and how many seats there are, and is if there's something out of whack, either in terms of saying we need more schools, that's a fair question, or saying if we have too many schools, should we then look to say, should we be raising the standard in those areas to make sure that we've got the best schools being the ones educating those kids?
Do we need to act more aggressively to get more school districts to combine with each other?
Well, I view that as a local question, but if you look on the face of it, I think we want to create incentives and encourage schools to look at that, school districts. Because it's interesting, when you talk to parents or kids, I mean, the things they really care about typically are the school. Most people don't think a lot of times about their school district. And if there's ways to save money or be more efficient, and in particular create an environment where you can put more resources in the classroom, that could be a good answer.
And what could you do to encourage school districts to maybe look at that?
We've actually done that in the past, where we put aside some budget resources to actually allow for dollars for places that want to go study that or help on working on the consolidation process. We actually had a situation this last year where Albion and Marshall High Schools came together, not the school districts, but the schools themselves. And that turned
out to be
successful.
Although that was managing a crisis.
But that was a successful case that got managed through because both communities worked hard on making it work. So in many cases, I view it as something that's really got to be driven at the local level with us being a supporting resource.
Cuts to higher education, the cuts that were made initially in your administration, that those still have not been fully restored. What is your goal as far as funding for a higher education?
Yeah, it's to restore them, Rick. I mean, again, we had $1.5 billion deficit, so had to make a lot of tough cuts the first year I got in office. And I was happy this last year. We'd made cost of living increases the couple of years before, but we made a significant move towards restoring that cut. And if you looked at my budget presentation, actually I had a slide in there that talked about restoring that full cut.
Mm-hmm. Do we focus too much right now on 4-year degrees at the expense of associate's degrees and professional licenses and that sort of thing?
Well, the answer is yes, but a couple things. This is a longer situation, but this is a national problem. We sort of broke our system for career tech education, not just associate's degrees, but really encouraging people to go in the trades. And it's beyond simply having the programs. It's a whole culture where parents and kids are not looking at great career tech ed programs the way they used to. So what we did about 2 or 3 decades ago is when we came out and said that basically we should push people to get a university degree. Now, I never want to discourage that. Again, that can be an important option for people, and we don't want to discourage that. We need to equally emphasize career tech education, which gets into associate's degrees or intermediate school districts in their training programs. There are literally tens of thousands of great jobs out there. And when I say skilled trades, welder, plumber, electrician are the ones we always think about. But if you're on the production floor today, you're a skilled tradesperson. If you're in agriculture today, you're a skilled tradesperson. And so these are great, well-paying jobs. Let's fill them up. So I actually have that as the top priority as I go into a second term, is to make Michigan the leader in career tech education and helping people get career connected to these great, well-paying jobs.
Do you feel like you have a partner in the legislature in that regard?
Yeah, I have to this point. It's been good. We've actually done 2 or 3 things. That we set aside a special fund for skilled trade training. We put aside some resources for community colleges for capital equipment to give them the resources to upgrade their facilities to do better career tech education. They've been supportive of programs like Matt Squared. I brought the German apprenticeship model back to Michigan. It's the Michigan Advanced Technician Training Program. And the way it works, think about this. It's at Henry Ford and Oakland Community College. And it's basically say, start working for a company, alternate going to school. The company pays your tuition. After 3 years, you get your associate's degree, a guaranteed job, and a work commitment for 2 years. That's awesome.
Okay, great. We're going to wrap up this segment, Governor. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, more of your questions. You're listening to Michigan Calling, an hour with Rick Snyder on the Michigan Public Radio Network. And welcome back. I'm Rick Pluta here with Republican Governor Rick Snyder, a candidate for re-election, and we are taking your questions. The number is 313-577-1019. Again, 313-577-1019. You can also ask a question on Facebook. Find us at Michigan Calling. Tweet us. Use the hashtag Michigan Calling. And our first question, Governor, in this segment is from Mary in Royal Oak. Mary, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Governor. My question to you is, you've given tax cuts to businesses, and in that regard, you have asked seniors and middle-class families to sacrifice, while you've helped others, like increases in salaries to your Treasury Department, but taxing pensions, taking away deductions for income tax, which affects the middle and low-income people. Why did you do that?
Well, Mary, I think you asked about 4 or 5 questions in there. So,
well, let's start with the pension tax. That was part of a whole tax package. So explain your rationale for that tax package, because it did increase taxes on some seniors.
Actually, that's a misstatement when it says seniors. If you look how the system works, it was really about essentially removing an exclusion on pension income.
But they paid more in taxes.
So the first thing we did as part of that process is to say, let's look at our system. And what we did is to say, if you had certain kinds of retirement income, you'd pay no Michigan tax, regardless of your age. So we had many people that were retiring at 40, 50 and not paying any tax for the rest of their lives on that income. And if you think about it, is that really a fair answer with respect to other situations where you have seniors still having to work that were paying Michigan income tax? Or the fact that in many respects, when I was campaigning, everyone said we want to keep our kids in Michigan. If you make it so retirement income isn't taxed, you're shifting your tax burden essentially to your kids to say, we want you to carry us. And that's not a fair answer. So what did we do? We made modifications. And the first part of it is we grandfathered in all our seniors. We defined seniors as 67 and older. So none of the tax law changed with respect to retirement income for anyone in that category. For anyone
who are 67 at the time
at that
came in, obviously people who are 67 years old at some point and above will be paying the tax and pension.
Let's walk through that, Rick. The next piece is we put a transition for people between 60 and 67. So we gave them a special exemption of up to $40,000 for a married couple for that kind of income in addition to the transition. So they had a much more favorable case. So the people that really get affected by this are people before they're seniors in terms of their retirement income, or if they have high retirement income. And what we did is, instead of having that, we put in an exemption for all seniors of up to $40,000 for a married couple for any kind of income. So what we did is we now made it fair for those people working. They had to work. They're not going to pay Michigan income tax now where they used to have to. And now it's fair between people that had retirement income and people that had working income. The only seniors that really will pay is if you have a pension income of income well above $40,000. Once you get above $40,000, you can be affected by it. Or if you're younger and you're not a senior. So that was part of this, is let's make a fairer long-term system that really makes it for the income working people, the people still having to work. They have a much fairer situation. It's still one of the top 10 most generous schemes in the country.
What about the rest of Mary's question? The exemptions for the rest of the other exemptions that were eliminated.
Well, again, we simplified our tax code in a lot of ways. Let me talk about the issue about business, who benefited, because again, that's another misinformation piece out. Because a lot of times people like to characterize this as big business winning. Big business did not get a tax benefit from the tax changes we made. That didn't happen at all. In fact, we changed. The simple facts are is the corporate tax rate is 6%. The individual tax rate is 4.25%. And I wiped out most of the tax credits in the corporate tax code. One of the few credits remaining is for small business. What we did was make a fair tax system because it was really small and medium-sized businesses, the people that create jobs. We were putting a huge burden on their back. Think about this. They were paying the Michigan income tax because it flows through. So we pay taxes on our wages. I pay tax on my salary as governor. Small business people were paying on the income of their business, but then we said, let's stick them with another tax. We were taxing them more than what we were paying. That's not a fair answer, particularly when they're the job creators. So the tax reform we did was essentially say, let's take away that second tax and now create a fair system that we're simply asking them to pay the same tax rate the same way you and I pay on our salary. And that helps generate more jobs, and that's the fair answer. So that's the tax reform that really happened. It wasn't about big business. Again, I wiped out their tax credits. They have a higher tax rate than individuals. That wasn't a big win.
One more quick tax question.
Yeah.
Do you see value in increasing the state earned income tax credit for poor working families?
Well, there's one huge challenge on that, Rick. Again, that was something that we did scale back to some degree. It's really a federal program, and the way our program works in Michigan is we simply take a percent of whatever that federal credit is, and we are paying that. It used to be 20%. Now it's 6%. Some people have suggested bringing that back to some degree. And one of the challenges to do that is if you look at the Internal Revenue Code themselves, the Auditor General for the IRS has basically come out and issued a report that says over 20% of the payments under this program are improper. So one of the real questions is should we be looking to reinvest in a program where the federal government themselves comes out and says more than 20% of those payments are improper? That's hard to justify.
Okay. We are going to go now to a listener in Warren who has a question about jobs.
Hi, my name is Tamika Collier, and I'm from Warren, Michigan. And my friend has been unemployed for almost 2 months, and she's still waiting for her unemployment check. So what can be done about the unemployment issues?
Well, again, that sounds like a particular issue. I wish, actually, if we can find out, if Rick can tell us how to get your friend's name, we'd be happy to follow up on it. Because, again, we want to give good customer service. And as someone's unemployed and deserves, you know, assistance, we need to help work on that. So I view that more as an individual case, and if we can figure out how we can get your friend's name and information, we'll be happy to follow up.
Okay, now we're going to go to Steve from Lansing. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me. Good morning, Governor. How are you?
Good, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I've got a question about education funding. I understand that the first year you took office, there's about $1 billion in federal stimulus money that dried up, which used to go towards education. Is that right?
That's correct.
Well, here's my question is, you know, everyone knew that money was drying up. It wasn't a surprise. Why did we not backfill that and try to restore the cuts that we knew were coming? And instead, we gave a big tax cut to business. We could have given it towards education.
Well, let's go walk through the history there. Is actually my predecessor, the prior administration, the prior government, cut state education funding. And they cut that back in the 2008-2009 timeframe, and they backfilled that cut with federal stimulus dollars that, again, as you said, were only intended to last a couple years. So that was a problem created before. That hole was going to come. So the way I view it is we tried to do the best. Again, I had an overall $1.5 billion deficit to deal with. And so we've invested a lot with state dollars in K-12. So that goes back to that misinformation point when people say I cut education for state dollars. That's absolutely incorrect. We've been investing over $1 billion in the first 3 years, $1 billion more in this last budget year. And again, it wasn't at giving big business benefits. I just explained in the prior question or two that big business didn't benefit from the tax cuts were taking place. It was really making a fair tax system because the Michigan business tax was the dumbest tax in the country. If you go down to Ohio and Indiana, they'll tell you that was one of their greatest tools for economic development, taking jobs out of Michigan. And so we got rid of a dumb tax and replaced it with a fair, simple system that actually requires good higher payments in some ways from corporations, larger corporations, and at the same time makes it fair for small and medium-sized businesses.
Okay, let's start talking a little bit about cities with a call from John in Mount Pleasant. John, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you. Governor, how are you doing? I wanted to ask you, with Detroit and Flint and the larger cities having financial problems, what's the plan on helping those cities, getting those back? And also a while back, they mentioned about opening up to immigrants for Detroit to come over. Immigrants are the building blocks of America, and it seems to me that we need to, you know, use some type of program to get the cities working again. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I appreciate your question. I will take it in two parts. One, what about the cities? And then secondly, on immigration. On the cities themselves, we've made some significant progress in a number of cities. For example, we had emergency manager situations in Pontiac and Benton Harbor, and both of those have transitioned out back to the city. In Flint, we're making progress. That's one of our challenging situations. One of the things that has slowed us down is there's litigation. There's a court case that we're waiting for the full resolution of, that if we can get that resolved, then hopefully we can move out of Flint in the next year. Detroit, obviously, is the biggest one with the bankruptcy case. And if you look at it, we've made tremendous progress in the city of Detroit. We're now down to the trial part of hopefully affirming the plan of adjustment, which would be a huge positive opportunity for Detroit to move forward and grow the city. At the same time, a lot of great things have gone on. Midtown, downtown's doing fabulous. Again, streetlights are going up. A lot of streetlights have gone up. Trash is being picked up, recycling's taking place, public safety is improving throughout the city. There's a lot of great things going on, so we're on a positive path there. But we need to keep it up. We can't take it for granted. In particular, we need to emphasize helping the neighborhoods. There's still many challenged places. On immigration, I've been very proactive on immigration. I appreciate your question. I created the Office of New Americans to really focus in on how do we encourage more legal immigration. Again, the whole question of illegal immigration is a very polarizing question, but to the degree we can get legal.
Is your party right on that on that question of immigration?
I really have the position, the view that we do need a comprehensive solution, and Washington needs to come up with a better answer. But it's a federal question, Rick. We need a better answer. It just doesn't work, our current system. And that gets back to this legal immigration question that I have encouraged the people in Washington to look at giving us a program to bring 50,000 immigrants to Detroit that are highly skilled. Again, the evidence, the reason that I think we got good bipartisan support for that is because if you look at the evidence for highly skilled immigrants, people with master's and advanced degrees, that they literally are job creators. They'll create 1.5 jobs for every position they occupy. So they would actually generate a lot more jobs for our cities.
Is it fair to characterize that as actually selling visas to the highest bidder?
No, not in that particular case. You might be thinking the EB-5 program, Rick, which is about entrepreneurship investment. And
this, well, that'll ask the question about EB-5 then.
Yeah, the category I'm talking about, though, is the two category, which is basically highly skilled. And the interesting part on the highly skilled, this is part showing how messed up our system is we graduate 1,800 students a year with an advanced degree in science, technology, engineering, and math that are foreign nationals from Michigan universities, and we tell them to get out. The federal government tells them to leave. After they've come here, we've given them a world-class education, they want to stay here, we tell them to get out. That's dumb. So we could keep them here in good, well-paying jobs that would be net job generators. On the EB-5 program, it's really getting investment into the United States, and it's not the highest bidder. It's really there are certain criteria, and you have to create so many jobs.
And you have to have a lot of money.
Well, again, it is a significant amount of money. It depends on the particular version that you're in. It's either $500,000 to $1 million, but you have to create 10 jobs as part of that process. So there is a job creation element to that, and that's being used widely across the country.
Okay, getting back to Detroit specifically, mm-hmm. and cities in general, explain to our listeners in Lansing, in Grand Rapids, in Traverse City, in northern Michigan, Marquette, why the Detroit bankruptcy matters to them.
Sure. If you think about it in terms of, I'll put it in the context of the grand bargain, because we had broad bipartisan support to do the grand bargain.
And they helped pay for it.
And, well, again, that's a fair question to ask, and that's why I'm happy to walk through it, is there are several what I would call factual bases to say you can put support on for it. One is just the social service cost. If we didn't otherwise be part of the grand bargain, which is bringing hundreds of millions of other dollars that are non-state dollars to the solution, bringing them into the state from foundations and other donors, we would be in a situation where it could cost us more than that in the terms of social safety net costs that we'd otherwise have to provide. So there's one justification. The second one is litigation. In terms of court costs and everything else and years of additional litigation, that we can save a huge amount of money by getting it resolved. And part of this is they're agreeing to move forward and not sue the state as part of this process and continue litigation. One of the greatest benefits, though, I like to bring back to people is pure Michigan. Just the whole image of the state. Because I like to ask people, if you're a Michigander, when you talk to somebody out of state or out of country, how often when it comes up that you're from Michigan, does the whole conversation almost automatically go to problems in Detroit? And it starts on a negative note quite often. They have a negative image of Detroit, although they don't recognize all the good things going on. Mm-hmm. And you spend the first 5 or 10 minutes going through this whole litany before you get to talk about what you think is great in Michigan. Think about it. That's been our entire life, Rick. Now we're to the point where by this fall, but getting this done, we can start by saying, isn't it great? Detroit's on a comeback. And let me tell you about the great things in our state. That has tremendous value.
Well, so Detroit's on the comeback, but Detroit is not the only city where we are hoping people will live. We have Flint, Saginaw, Benton Harbor, Muskegon. Do they also deserve a grand bargain to help
them? Well, again, the magnitude of their issue wasn't in the same scale in terms of their smaller communities, but if you look at how far they are in debt in a relative sense, it was nowhere in the same kind of situation in most of those circumstances. And so Detroit was unique in that. In addition to being our largest city, the magnitude of the problem, the scale of the problem was absolutely huge, and it was great to see the foundation community together, the mediators. Everyone's done a great job of coming up with a solution.
Okay, we're going to go to a phone call now from Jim in Bloomfield Hills. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for taking my call.
So your question.
This question goes just straight to the question of the democratic process and the public will. How, Governor Snyder, do you defend signing into legislation, replacement legislation for the Emergency Financial Manager Act that the public clearly voted down during the 2012 election? And how can the public trust that their vote will count while you're in office?
Jim, thanks for the question. Governor?
Yeah, I appreciate that, Jim. Actually, what we did was look at some of the key issues and concerns that were clear about the public vote. That got to the point of how long someone was in the position and did the communities have other options to choose. So we modified the law to take those into account. So what we did was look at, okay, here are the issues, here are some of the primary criticisms, and put that into account in having a new law that go forward. To put some history on the emergency manager law system really started under Governor Blanchard back in 1980. And to be blunt, it didn't work well. Emergency managers had been far too long in communities, not really able to solve the problems. So when I got in office, it was really emergency managers should be there for the emergency. They should get in, do their job, get done, and get out, and get it back to the community. So we put in a law. Again, people had issues with some of the things, such as what's the process and what choices do communities have? Are they forced to take an emergency manager versus other options? That was one of the reasons the vote went the way it did. The new law actually allows choices to communities. They can talk about consent agreements. They can talk about essentially mediation in some fashion. They can talk about emergency managers. And we've actually had cases where communities are asking for emergency managers.
Governor, we have a Twitter question from Matt Forrester, who asks, the events in Ferguson have raised questions about police tactics in Michigan. Is this something we need to be proactive on? Are there things that we need to be looking at in terms of the equipment, the military-style equipment that police departments can acquire through the federal government, the tactics that they use? What questions have, from what we've seen going on in Ferguson, what questions have they raised with you?
Yeah, again, you have both probably the tactics even more than the equipment to some degree are fair questions to ask. The other one is more, what's the relationship with the police department and the government with the citizens in terms of building community ties and relationships? Because, again, the goal is to not have situations like that happen at all. And I would illustrate a couple communities where we've worked hard, and I think there's been tremendous progress, Flint and Saginaw in particular. Again, those are two communities, unfortunately, that are among the most violent in the country. We have four in the state of Michigan. And I was fortunate, I went up to Flint this last year, and I did a roundtable session, and it had almost all these different constituencies at the table. We had the Michigan State Police, but we had the sheriff, we had the local police, we had the prosecutor, we had judges, we had community leaders, we had people from the clergy there. We had people from all these organizations talking about how we're making sure that
we understand that aggressive law enforcement can actually inflame a situation.
That's my point, Rick. That's why we're trying to do these proactively in Flint and Saginaw, Detroit, these kind of communities where we're having these community meetings and dialogue, because, again, no one wants to get in that situation where you get that confrontation to begin with. And so we're working hard to do preventative measures.
Mm-hmm. What name very quickly in 5 seconds or less, just one thing that you have learned from those roundtables.
It's about talking. It's about keep talking.
Okay. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, more of your questions for Governor Rick Snyder. You're listening to Michigan Calling, an hour with Governor Snyder here on the stations of the Michigan Public Radio Network. And welcome back to Michigan Calling. I'm Rick Pluta, the Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, here with Republican Governor Rick Snyder, who would like you to vote for him for re-election. And this hour, we are taking your calls and your questions. The phone number to join us is 313-577-1019. Again, that's 313-577-1019. You can message us on Facebook. We're at Michigan Calling. You can tweet us. Use the hashtag MICalling. What questions do you have for Governor Snyder? And Governor Dylan from Hazel Park has a question for you. Dylan, thanks for joining us. Dylan, are you with us?
Hi, hello.
Hi, Dylan.
Hi, sorry about that. Yes, my question is, I was wondering why the governor has such a strong stand against the equal rights for gay marriage.
Governor, your position on gay marriage, your name is on that particular lawsuit.
Yes, largely because I'm governor of Michigan. As a practical matter, it's really the courts are going to decide this matter. I've said that it's in the court system and they're going through that process. It was something decided by the people in Michigan's Constitution several years ago. They voted on the definition of marriage being between a man and a woman. And as a practical matter, that's Michigan's Constitution. So now it's going through the court system to see what the answer is. And the Attorney General is the one that primarily pursuing this. And he's doing the appropriate action of saying, well, that's what the Constitution says, so he needs to defend the Constitution of the state of Michigan.
When we talk about inclusiveness and being inviting for all kinds of people, workers, mm-hmm. a lot of companies, a lot of businesses that are actively supporting your reelection say it's time not only to get this issue aside from us, but also amend the state's civil rights law to include protections for LGBT people. Would it be good for the state, for the courts to rule that same-sex marriage is legal, and for the state to amend Elliot Larson to allow for employment and housing protections for LGBT people?
Yeah, Rick, what I'd say is that, one, the marriage question is before the courts, and so that's a decision to be made by them. With respect to Elliot Larson, I've made it clear that I don't believe in discrimination, and I think it would be appropriate for the legislature at some point to take up a discussion, and I've been encouraging them to take up that discussion of Elliot Larson.
So should those things be included in the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act? You do not. The legislature does not take up a discussion for the academic purpose of discussing things. It is for the purpose of sending bills to the governor's desk to sign.
Well, that's not always the case. Again, let's have a good dialogue, good discussion before the legislature. And again, that's where the forum should be, and that's where we can have public hearings. We can have a great public dialogue on it. And I've been encouraging, and I think the speaker actually previously had sent signs that he was interested in the topic at some point. It's just now a question of, you know, we are in election season and then there's a lame duck session.
I've covered Lansing for 30 years. I'm not aware of a debate that occurs in the legislature without the purpose in the end being to get a law passed. Would you sign that bill if it were sent to you?
Well, again, I don't do hypotheticals on bills.
That's
not a hypothetical. I've been consistent on a long time that, again, I wait until a bill gets to my desk and I do my analysis.
Okay, we're going to go now to Mike in Rochester Hills. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Governor, this is Mike in Rochester Hills. My question has to do with oil and gas drilling in residential areas like Rochester Hills. I know there's a bill before you. It's on its way to you called Bill 1026. Here in Rochester Hills, the city council has been not transparent, dodging the issue, and we've got a tight community, 70,000 people. Setbacks are only 450 feet. This is not an industrial area.
Mike, could you get to your question, please? Just we have a lot of people lined up waiting to ask something. Sure.
Governor, what can we do to stop drilling in Rochester Hills?
Yeah, Mike, I appreciate your question because, again, if you look at it, it's a fair question to ask because much of the legislation on oil and gas really didn't contemplate urban environments necessarily. So that's a discussion we're already trying to have through the Department of Environmental Quality. Again, I'm not familiar with the particular bill. There was a couple bills that went through in the last couple of years, but I would have to check on that one, and I'll be happy to follow up on that bill. But what we're trying to do now is get the communities talking with the oil and gas industry. In fact, we've had an agreement to stop some drilling in Macomb County on the particular topic that you're discussing. It's also happening over in Washtenaw County. So I think it's something that, one, we want to bring people together to have a dialogue between the industry and folks short of legislation to see if we can come to better answers and better resolution. And then if required, again, that could be a topic that should be discussed legislatively.
But you do believe that drilling is appropriate?
Well, it's a balancing act when you get into extremely urbanized areas. Again, residential neighborhoods, it's really how do you do it in a way that you have to respect, you know, the number of people living there. In many cases in Michigan, people are actually excited to see it because it brings in good revenue to the landowners and the people living in that area. So again, how do we strike that right balance when you get into very populated areas?
Okay, we have a question from Kai, and this is from Facebook, who wants to know your thoughts about the 60-year-old pipeline that's under the Straits of Mackinac.
Well, it's a concern, and we've been proactive on that. Dan Wyatt, the director of the Department of Environmental Quality, and Attorney General Bill Schuette, I asked them to work together on this. They sent a letter to Enbridge some time ago that Enbridge has responded to. So now we're doing different stakeholder meetings. We're meeting with Enbridge to have a discussion about the status of the pipeline and the future of the pipeline. And so we want to have an active dialogue on that to see what the issues are because, again, having a pipeline underneath the Great Lakes is a concern. As a practical matter, we also need to understand the constraints that it's primarily a federal regulatory issue. We actually don't have a lot of direct influence over this question, but we thought by holding public forums and really having a dialogue and discussion, it could be something helpful that we can go to the federal government as appropriate to make sure our viewpoint's heard.
We have another Facebook question from Elizabeth in Brighton, and it's really two questions. And one is, what plans do you have to improve Michigan's renewable energy portfolio? And why don't we start there?
Sure. We're looking at that. That's something we started the process about a year ago. And we should be increasing our renewable energy portfolio. We've essentially hit the 10% kind of goal, you know, in terms of what we were trying to achieve. The 15% in terms of doing that. And so the right thing is, what's our next long-term policy? What do we do for the next 10 and 20 years?
Should there be a law that increases that number?
What I would say, Rick, is I think it's fair to say there's room to increase. Some of the things we've done in Michigan over the last few years have been pretty efficient. Some of the wind energy projects. But it needs to be done in the context of the fact that there's no federal energy policy. So the facts can change. So we want an adaptable policy. What I would say is we need to move to a much cleaner energy policy in our state that moves away from coal and sources like that to cleaner sources that include renewables but also natural gas. And it's like, what's the right balance between those two?
Okay, and now we have a phone call from Karen in Lake Station. Karen, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Governor. Thank you for taking my question. I want to know what kind of leadership you'll be providing the state of Michigan to acknowledge the reality of global warming and put mitigation measures in place, such as a carbon tax that would rebate the money back to the people and support for soil restoration projects as a good carbon sink.
Well, what I'd say is, Karen, without getting into one of the controversies you get is there global warming? What caused it? What I would say is it's clear the volatility of weather and the challenges are more. And we're being proactive. That gets back to that last question on energy policy. I think we clearly can move an energy policy in Michigan that relies much less on coal, which is a dirty source, to much cleaner sources such as natural gas and renewables. And we can be aggressive. One of the things I really want to emphasize that doesn't get talked about enough, it gets overlooked, is energy savings. Avoiding wasted energy. Again, that was something missing when the ballot proposal happened last time that I thought was egregious in some ways. We should be starting with that, and I think we can be aggressive on how do we not use energy by better practices to begin with. So there's a lot of opportunity to do things there. And your question of storing carbon or carbon dioxide, we actually have a big opportunity in Michigan. We actually have one of the largest storage opportunities for either natural gas or CO2 in the country. So there are opportunities, and there's work going on to look to do that. It was cool. I was at a company recently that was in the timber business, and what they did is they brought a supplier on site because what they're doing now is they're making a product for their production process that really takes carbon dioxide from their emissions from their kiln operations and puts it into this production method instead of emit it to the atmosphere. So they're actually recycling it into making a raw material for them to produce things and avoiding the CO2 discharge in the atmosphere. That's the kind of creativity that I think is fabulous.
Okay, we're going to change tracks a little bit here to talk about guns, and we have a question from Joan in Okemos. Joan, thanks for joining us.
Hi. I'm very concerned about gun control and about the age that children are allowed to take gun training. And I was wondering what age the governor thinks is appropriate for training people to shoot, and what's the Michigan law?
Yeah, we actually have, under supervision, younger kids can use them, but they have to be supervised, and again, in a thoughtful fashion. Because again, we're a state where hunting, for example, is a big tradition in our state. And that's part of a family bonding situation where quite often parents want to take their kids out, teach them how to hunt, but it needs to be done in a thoughtful and careful fashion. And so I think we've been very prudent about making sure it's not about just giving kids rifles or something. It's about making sure it's done in a supervised, thoughtful fashion and kids are safe. Because, again, that's the starting point. We want these children to be safe.
You know, we also asked this question of your opponent. Would you be in favor of some type of limitations on the sorts of firearms that people could own, limits on magazine capacity, for example?
Yeah, in terms of looking at something to work on, I don't put that on my list of things because, again, I think the more important question is working on better mental health issues. And we've made a huge investment in mental health. I think we're becoming one of the leaders in terms of being more proactive. We're working hard on better school and safety environments in terms of more school drills, more training in schools. One of the things is we created an OK to Say hotline. I signed that legislation. That hotline is going to get launched, which is basically a tip line for any kind of concern about violence in schools of any sort, including bullying.
But one of the issues with mental health is that people go in and out of services. And so that only works as long as people are getting services. And is there an issue that needs to be dealt with in terms of access to weapons, especially high-capacity weapons, when it comes to people with mental illness?
Again, I think the better value is spending our time on the front-end question about how do we identify things, how do we create opportunities for people to identify people, how do we do the counseling process, how do we find that? Because in most cases, if you looked at the situations where problems have happened, a lot of those signs weren't spotted.
And for people who aren't getting or won't get those services?
Well, again, that's where we have to have good follow-up. Those are fair questions to ask, Rick, but we're doing the front-end questions about OK to Say in terms of the hotline, the tip lines, doing better mental health services, better counseling for people, and ways to help people.
Okay, and we've got a question from Wayburn in Grand Rapids. Wayburn, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. I have a question in respect to the recent Supreme Court ruling, the Michigan Supreme Court ruling on juvenile lifers and not giving them a second chance. I'm wanting to know from the governor, how can we justify the fact that these kids, a lot of these kids did this when they were young and their minds were not completely developed. And how can we justify sentencing them to life without parole and also sentencing them to the fact that they may not or cannot be rehabilitated and must spend the rest of their lives behind bars?
Okay, Wayburn, thanks for your question. The United States Supreme Court has ruled that you cannot sentence a juvenile to life without parole without a hearing that takes into account their specific circumstances. Automatic life without parole is no longer allowed. We have roughly 360 people serving in Michigan prisons right now, and there is a fight over whether or not they should be parole eligible. Governor, should those 300-plus inmates be eligible for parole?
What I'd say is that's a question that I spend most of my time on the jobs question, but it's a reasonable question to ask. But I view that as something that I would hope if the legislature wants to take it up, they should address that because it's a balancing act. One of the questions you have to ask are, in particular, you most likely will hear a lot from the families of the victims that may have a different opinion on
and that's
this
what parole hearings are for. Should these people get parole
this
hearings?
This is a question of saying if it's to go retroactive, is it a question the legislature wants to take up and address? And again, I'm happy to have that discussion with them.
We have a question now from Steve in Alpena. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Hi. Good morning, Governor. Why don't the state of Michigan just legalize or decriminalize pot? It would quit making criminals out of people who aren't criminals. It would give the police agencies time to investigate real crime, and it would create income for the state. Thank you.
Okay. Steve, thank you very much. And a man from Ann Arbor has got to be ready for that question.
Steve, what I'd say is it doesn't make it legal. It's against federal law. And that's one of the key questions. In fact, we passed a law through the Michigan legislature that said if the federal law changes, Michigan law will accommodate that.
Well, this is something that a lot of a lot of people at your level are saying that this is something that states ought to be experimenting with in order to influence federal policy. What amendments would you make as one the leader of one of the laboratories of democracy regarding marijuana laws to maybe help affect that federal policy?
Yeah, well, it gets back to, again, you have finite time and resources that you have to work on, Rick, when you're in this position. And to be blunt with you, I'm going to spend more of my time on career tech education. Because I view those are great, well-paying jobs. There's tens of thousands of them. In a relative sense to addressing a marijuana question, that we still need a federal law change if it's going to really do anything to make it legal. I'm going to spend my time on where I can help people get jobs, have a better lifestyle. And it's working in Michigan. We've created nearly 300,000 private sector jobs. Personal income's coming back. We got a lot of great things, but there are many opportunities out there for more people to be employed. And so my priority, very clear priority, is the jobs question.
You know, we got quite a few questions on this. In your first term, why, when you said so often, Governor, this is from Deborah in Richmond via Facebook, why, when you said that it wasn't on your agenda, did you sign right to work into law?
Sure. I'm happy that people asked that question because it was a change in circumstance that Proposal 2 went on the ballot. Basically, I met with labor and management during the summer, and Proposal 2 was about putting collective bargaining in Michigan's Constitution that would have destroyed Michigan's economy, in my view. It was a devastating proposal. And I suggested to him, I said, my real concern here is if you start on this path on collective bargaining, you're going to highlight the right to work issue, that you're going to put both issues on these tables. And in fact, I asked labor in particular not to go ahead with their petition drive.
That sounds an awful lot like payback.
No, it's not payback. Factually, that's why I walked through it, Rick, ahead of time. I didn't threaten. I just said my concern is if this goes forward, this is a likely consequence. And I don't think anyone disagreed with that. Everyone understood that could be a consequence. And so there's no threat. I don't threaten people. I just do my job. I'm there to solve problems. I don't believe in fighting with people. Mm-hmm. So that was a case where it went ahead. And again, it got defeated and appropriately defeated. And right to work was a consequence. And right to work's not a bad answer. It's a good answer. It's standing up for Michigan workers. They should have the freedom to choose. It's about representing Michigan people. And it's helped our business development pipeline in the state. We've got a lot more companies looking to build and stay in Michigan because of that.
Governor, we really just have a minute or so left, and I want to ask you a big picture question, mm-hmm. which is, what is at stake in November should you win or lose?
Sure. Well, what's at stake is it's really an affirmation that we are making tremendous progress in the recovery of Michigan. And do we want to see that continue and to actually accelerate? It's a tremendous opportunity. And if we don't, then there's an opportunity that we could end up back in 2009 to go back to the old ways of doing things, the broken political system way of doing things. And I don't want to see that. We've done great work. 300,000 private sector jobs being created in terms of personal income coming back, just home prices. We're the number one state in the nation for increases in home values in this last year. That's a great sign that things are coming back in our state. Many good things going on and many great things still to come. Again, we shouldn't be complacent or content with where we're at. There are still people that need help in terms of finding career opportunities. I want to get that job done.
In 10 seconds, what is the single best thing you did for Michigan in the last 3.5, 4 years?
Really start bringing it back where many people are seeing our best days are ahead of us instead of behind us. Many people's spirit was broken. And there are still people in that category. Let's get them excited, though, and have them see a bright future so our kids and our kids' kids can stay in Michigan.
Okay. Well, Governor, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your time this hour. And thank you all for your questions. Again, as I mentioned earlier, Democratic candidate Mark Schauer joined the program last month, and we posted that hour on the Michigan Calling Facebook page. Michigan Calling was produced by the amazing team of Zoe Clark, Joe Lindstroth, Jake Neer, and Laura Weber Davis. Matt Trevethan, the great Matt Trevethan, engineered our program. A special thanks to Michigan Radio and to WDET here in Detroit for hosting the program. I'm Rick Pluta. This has been a special broadcast on the Michigan Public Radio Network.